Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're discussing going minimalist to save more with Joshua Becker.
We've all heard about the minimalist lifestyle. Maybe you're picturing a bearded hipster drinking coffee in his empty, perfectly white dining room, right? It turns out that is not what minimalism is all about. We've all been spending more time in our homes than we'd probably like, and all that clutter might be getting to you. And so here to talk with us today about minimalist living is Joshua Becker. While beginning the process of removing possessions from his life, Joshua started the site Becoming Minimalist. And he's written several fantastic books over the years, including The More of Less and The Minimalist Home. Not only can a minimalist approach to life allow us to spend less and save more of our money, but it can have a positive impact in lots of areas of our life. So Joshua, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, it is my pleasure. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Anytime, man. Anytime. Seriously, if you want to come back next week too.
And by the way, if there's a bearded hipster in his dining room drinking coffee listening, I think that's fantastic. So
they might not need as many of these principles. They might have applied them already. We'll see. But Joshua, every week on the podcast, Matt and I drink a craft beer. It's kind of our way of splurging on something that we love now while also being intentional and saving well for the future. So today on the show, we're drinking a beer called I Feel It All by Monday Night Brewing. And what's your splurge? What's your craft beer equivalent?
What is my, well, by the way, Monday Night Brewing, I think I've been there.
I think you have. You were here in Atlanta last summer, right?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And last fall, we I've had two events there in the past year. Yeah,
you're friends with a buddy of ours, Jeff Schinnerbarger.
Yep.
I think you've done some events with him. He's Plywood People is his organization. They do some amazing stuff for sure.
Yeah, wonderful. Anyway, yeah, splurge. Good question. I've kind of moved away from buying possessions, buying things that I don't need. And I would say that, well, I've replaced it with a number of different things. One thing that we do like splurging on is trips, vacations, experiences. My kids are 17 and 13, and so my son's a junior and my daughter's in eighth grade. And I think all the research that's ever been done that experiences lead to more happiness than possessions, I've found that to be true. So while my kids are still at home, I've always wanted to create good memories and fun stories. And a lot of times those happen when we go away together as a family.
Well, with your kids being older like that, like, have you felt the urge to kind of squeeze in a few more of these experiences before your kids kind of go off to school or whatever it is they decide to move on to?
I have, indeed. And I don't know if it's an artificial urgency or not, but I certainly feel it. You only get 18 summers with your kids, or at least ideally, right? And then they're kind of moving on. And so Salem now is spring break for his junior year. And so, yeah, one or two more summers, one or two more spring breaks when you can create some of those memories. And from everything I can tell, talking to families, like, it doesn't end there, right? Even when they're in college, they come back and you do things. But you, I think you certainly feel that urgency.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, Joshua, let's talk about minimalism. And you know, from everything I've read about minimalism, I feel like it can be easily misunderstood. Everyone seems to kind of have a different definition of what it means. So kind of to set the stage for this conversation, what's your definition of minimalism?
Yeah, I think everybody, well, I don't know if everybody has a different definition of minimalism, but the way it plays out in a person's life is always going to look different from one person to another. Certainly, there are different definitions of it. The one that I have always used is this. Minimalism is the intentional promotion of the things I most value in life by removing anything that distracts me from it. In this way, it's not about, the goal of minimalism isn't how do I own the fewest amount of things as possible. The greatest promise of minimalism isn't just owning less stuff. The greatest goal of minimalism is that I get to pursue with more passion whatever my greatest priorities and greatest values are. And one way I do that, certainly in terms of physical possessions, is I stop wasting money on things that I don't need. I stop wasting time and energy, not just pursuing, but accumulating and maintaining and managing all the things that I own, and begin directing my most finite resources towards the things in life that matter most. And of course, that's going to look different from one person to another.
Yeah. And so to you, at least, what are some of the maybe misconceptions or like false ideas of what minimalism is that you've heard people share with you?
Yeah. So I was probably the first blog entirely dedicated to minimalism. I started writing about it 12 years ago. And so there were certainly a lot more misconceptions 12 years ago, but a lot more people are talking about it now than back then. But I think some of the major ones still pop into people's minds, you know, like the intro that's just for young college kids, that it means no beauty in life whatsoever, but it's just barren, that the goal is
white.
Yeah, that the goal is just to own the fewest amount of things that you possibly can, or that there's a certain number, you can't own more than 100 things. I think that there are those misconceptions, but probably the biggest misconception that I think continues to pervade is this idea that minimalism is a sacrifice in some way, that minimalism will lead to a boring life, that I have to get rid of all my things and my life is going to be boring and stale because of it, when the exact opposite is true. It's about getting rid of the things you don't need so that you can spend more of your life in passionate pursuit of the things that are most important to you. So I think that's probably the biggest one. And then, you know, just as I mentioned before, it's always going to look different from one person to another. If you're single, if you have three kids, if you're an empty nester, if you live in the city or you live in the suburb or are out in a rural area, if you're a farmer or a writer or a dentist, like all these things are going to change what you own in order to be who you want to be, or even where you live and what you need in order to live and get around.
When you were talking about that, Joshua, it kind of made me, it gave this picture popped in my head of like a monk in a cell. And I think maybe sometimes that's the idea that I've had of minimalism is kind of literally being devoid of possessions. And yeah, I think I'm interested to dive in a little more and hear kind of how we think about what we keep in our lives. And we've got some questions for you about that. But I want to know first, like for most people to even begin to explore the concept of minimalism or implementing any minimalist principles into their lives, you mentioned in your book that they need a tipping point. So I want to know, what was your tipping point? What led you to kind of go down this path?
Yeah. So for me, it was a Saturday morning. Yeah. 12 years ago now, I was living up in Vermont. My children were 5 and 2 at the time, and we were going to do our spring cleaning that weekend. And I offered to clean out the garage because I thought my 5-year-old son would want to help me clean out the garage. Obviously, what 5-year-old son wouldn't want to spend a day cleaning the garage, right?
Sounds like it's fun, Dad.
So he lasted about 30 seconds and he was in the backyard playing and I'm in the garage, and one thing leads to another. Hours later, I'm still working on the same garage. My son's asking me to come play catch with him, and I just keep pushing him off. I'm almost done. Well, I strike up a conversation with my neighbor who was outside doing all of her yard work at the time, and I think she noticed what was happening on my side of the hedge, and she makes a comment. Well, the joys of home ownership, huh, Joshua? And of course, she'd been working all morning too. And I said, well, you know what they say, the more stuff you own, the more your stuff owns you. And she responded by saying, yeah, you know, that's why my daughter is a minimalist. She keeps telling me I don't need to own all this stuff. And I remember looking at my driveway and there's this pile of dirty, dusty things I'd pulled out of the garage and spent all day cleaning. And Out of the corner of my eye, I see my 5-year-old son swinging alone on the swing set in the backyard. And suddenly I realized my possessions weren't making me happy, which I think all of us would say, right? We're not looking for happiness in our possessions. But the further realization was, not only were my possessions not making me happy, my possessions were actually taking me away from the very thing that did bring me happiness in life. And not just happiness, but meaning and joy and significance and purpose. And for me, that was the tipping point. I think that is the realization that a person has to make, that everyone who pursues a minimalist life at some point has that realization that not only are excess possessions not making us happy, but our excess possessions are actually taking us away from the very things that do bring us happiness in life. Because you don't sit across a table from somebody and ask them, what do you most want to accomplish in life? Nobody says, I just want to own as much junk as I possibly can. But somewhere along the way, society comes along and hijacks our passions, and we begin accumulating all these things that we don't need. And suddenly there comes a point where we realize, what am I? I'm wasting my life with those things when I could be doing far more important things with my life.
Right. Yeah. What a juxtaposition, right? Like, you paint such a good image, I mean, now, but in your book as well, when you kind of contrast this heap of dusty, crummy junk sitting there in the driveway, and then you have like this youthful person, you know, your son who you love, and he's back there. That really struck me pretty deep, having young kids about that age as well. And I mean, this is what you mean in your book too, like when you say that the payoff of minimalism, it's not a clean house. There are these bigger benefits and that we realize. Can you talk about some of these, I guess, like some of these universal benefits that pretty much everybody realizes as they kind of go down the path of minimalism?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, every time I speak, whenever time allows, I always have the person turn to the person next to them and say, start making a list of all the ways your life would improve if you own less stuff. And no one ever struggles to answer the question. Like when you ask, how would life improve if you owned less stuff? The list just grows. So we would have more time. We would have more money. We would do less cleaning. We would have less stress in life. We would have fewer decisions that need to be made. It would be a better life for the environment. We would be a better example for our kids. It'd be easier to find things in our house. We wouldn't need to constantly upgrade the size of our house. The average American home has tripled in size in the last 50 years, and still 10% of Americans rent offsite storage. It would pave the way for more contentment and more generosity and more gratitude. There's less comparison that we have with other people. We're able to own higher quality things. Right. If I'm going to own fewer anything, I can own a higher quality pairs of pants, watches, whatever it is. Fewer means I can own higher quality, less work for someone else. I mean, everything we own has to be dealt with at some point by somebody. Might as well do the work now.
Sure. Yeah. And Joshua, you've also given minimalism credit for your ability to start a nonprofit, which is called The Hope Effect. You did that with your wife, Kim. So can you tell us about The Hope Effect and how is minimalism responsible for your ability to do more good in the world around you, too?
Yeah. Well, how long do I have?
as much time as you want, man.
Yeah. I guess the medium length story is I started blogging, becomingminimalist.com. It was just going to be a journal, a diary of what I was getting rid of and what I was keeping. And it quickly grew. We have over 2 million readers every single month. And the social media reach is in the tens of millions that see our posts each and every week. And so at some point, publishers come calling and they say, hey, can you write a book? And I actually had 9 offers from publishers at the same time. And so I asked my agent, I said, what do we do? And he said, well, now they bid against each other to see who's going to pay the most for your book. It became pretty clear pretty early on that I was going to get offered a lot of money to write a book about how buying stuff won't make you happy. And
hopefully you don't see the irony in that, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we had cut our lifestyle down quite a bit. We'd moved into a smaller home, so our mortgage was less. We weren't buying a lot of things, and we just didn't need a lot of money to live our life. And so in conversations with Kim, we're like, what are we going to do? We're not going to buy a bigger screen television, are we? And so we decided to solve a problem in the world. And man, there is decades worth of research that traditional orphanages are actually pretty harmful for kids. When you picture the four walls, a bunch of kids and workers coming in and out, like most people, when they picture an orphanage, which is still used in most developing nations, that 70 to 90% of children that grow up in orphanages end up in homelessness, in prostitution, or incarcerated because brains just don't develop correctly outside of the family unit. And so our mission with the Hope Effect is to change how the world cares for orphans by helping orphan children get placed into families where they can receive the attention and affection that they should, as opposed to being in an orphanage. And just to say, like, an orphanage is better than nothing, like better than growing up on the streets. It's just not the best way for children to be raised. And so we work in Honduras and we work in Mexico. We just signed an agreement with the Mexican government to be one of the leading nonprofits to help recruit and train families to care for orphan children. So that's what the Hope Effect does. And because I buy less, because I don't need to spend money on stuff, I'm able to do something like this with it. And it's really exciting. I can't think of a more fulfilling way to spend my money than help orphan children have a chance at life.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously, man. Thanks so much for sharing the mission you've got there. It's amazing that through minimalism, you've been able to do something big, right? Like big and lofty. And I mean, that's essentially the goal that you've set forth in your books, is that, like, hey, like through this lifestyle, like through taking a different approach, you can implement these practices, some of these tips, and you can completely change what it looks like to live in our world today from one of consumption and doing unwise things with our money to not only being financially responsible, but then to be able to go beyond that and do something amazing like what you're doing. We'll ask you for some links here at the end of the episode where folks can go there if they're looking to donate and
partner up.
Yeah, and support you for sure. But at the very least, we do want our listeners, hopefully there'll be lots of nonprofits started after this conversation, maybe, years down the road.
Yeah. And I mean, they don't even need to be started. Like there are a lot of nonprofits that are doing a lot of good work. And that was, the first question that we had to ask ourselves was, do we start something new or do we partner with someone who's already doing good work? And
there you go.
It was not an easy question to answer. And we got asked it numerous times. And I'd like to think we fell on the right side of it. And you don't have to sign a big book deal to start helping out either, so.
Exactly. Yeah, well, so at the very least, too, we want our listeners to be able to have changed their life through minimalism, hopefully, to be able to contribute, to be able to get themselves in a better position financially. And so we're going to talk more about ways to better ourselves when it comes to personal finance. We'll get to that after the break.
All right, we're back from the break, and we're talking with Joshua Becker, who writes about minimalism on his website, Becoming Minimalist. He's also written some great books, too. Joshua, you mentioned in your book that Americans spend $1.2 trillion annually on non-essential goods. And you mentioned, too, that we spend 3,680 hours of our lives looking for things we've misplaced. I swear, I spend half of those hours just helping my wife find her cell phone. So what kind of effects do you think frugality and minimalism have on each other? Like, how closely related are they?
Oh, that's a good question. When I typically explain minimalism to people, I usually make a point to say that minimalism and frugality are not the same thing. There are a lot of people who pursue minimalism because they're frugal, but that's not always the case. And someone can pursue a minimalist life and spend just as much money, even on physical possessions, as they did before, if they're just buying a lot higher quality things with their money, then they can still spend just as much money. So in some ways, I believe very strongly that most people who pursue minimalism end up saving money in the long run, but it's not automatic that everyone who does that will start saving money. There still has to be the, okay, how, if I want to save money, how can I pursue minimalism in a way that allows me to do that? And if you start with that assumption, then certainly there you can see it all over, right? I'm just buying less stuff. I'm taking care of less stuff. Right. We moved into a smaller home because we realized we didn't need as much square footage as we had, and so we saved $1,000 a month on our mortgage. Like, there are very significant ways that you can do that. I think probably the most helpful connection that people can see is that most people already have enough stuff already. Like, there are enough clothes in your closet already. There's enough cookware in your kitchen. There's enough tools in your garage. You have enough hobby gear already. And as you start donating clothes from your closet, the mind shift becomes, wait, I don't need to go buy more clothes. I had more than I needed. I don't need to go buy more cookware. I'm getting rid of cookware. I don't need more towels. I'm getting rid of towels. And so the consumption mindset that I need to go buy more things starts to change as we realize, wait, I have more than I need, not I have to go buy more stuff already. Someone who wants to be frugal will find plenty more opportunities to be frugal pursuing a minimalist life. I guess is probably what I should have said. If someone doesn't want to be frugal, they can still pursue minimalism and spend even more money than they did before. But someone who wants to embrace those principles will find it easier to embrace those as they pursue a minimalist lifestyle, for sure.
Yeah, those powers combined are excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I guess so, like, an example I can think of, Joshua, is that kind of counter, that this sort of the opposite of that. It was like, I'm thinking of maybe someone who has a bunch of stuff around, right? Like, they're keeping unused or barely used things, maybe in their attic or down in the basement, in case that they need them, or maybe in case like they want to pull it out for like that one time of year that they might use it. And so, like, I feel like that's an example where someone wouldn't necessarily consider themselves a minimalist if they're hanging onto all those things. And their argument would be that they are saving money to not have to purchase those things again.
Okay. Right. I could see that. Right. The counteracting thought would be, do I really have to go buy that thing if I need to use it again? So kind of the classic example is our folding table. We got rid of our folding table and chairs, and then we decided we were going to host a party on Halloween, and we didn't have the folding table. And it took me about 30 seconds to call my neighbor who has a folding table, and we could borrow theirs. Certainly, especially in this sharing economy world that we're living in, right? Like, being able to find something that I ended up needing isn't nearly as difficult as it might be. If it is something that is rare and my neighbor's not going to have it and it's really expensive and there's a really good chance that I'm going to need it in a couple months, then I think you hold on to it. But if it's, I might need it some point, then there becomes two costs to that. There becomes everything we own takes up physical space in our home, but it also takes up mental space in our mind. And so storing all those things, it's constantly there in our space, and we know it's there and we think about it. Plus, how our mind begins to shift when we start realizing how much excess we have. And when we start seeing all the things that we can get rid of and life still goes on and life even becomes more enjoyable by owning less, then that brings about maybe an abundance mindset as opposed to a scarcity mindset that I need to hold on to these things. It just begins to change the way I see the world and the way I see my things, realizing that I actually have more than I need, not that I don't have enough stuff. And so I have to keep holding on to and accumulating things.
Yeah. On that note, Joshua, have you seen people kind of dip their toes in and then they kind of start to see how good it can be? And then they just kind of start to go whole hog with it because they realize that starting to get there, fixing, you know, one aspect of their life in regards to minimalism and starting to declutter and change their mindset. Have you seen people just kind of go a little bit and then realize, oh man, I got to go the whole way? Or usually does it happen quickly or is it usually a longer, more drawn out process?
Oh, I think it happens in any and every possible way, depending on a person's personality and family and starting point and what they're thinking about and stage of life and any number of different things. But to answer your question, yeah, I think people certainly can sample it a little bit and begin to see the benefits of it. In fact, it's the approach that I take when I encourage people. How do I start applying these principles in my home and in my life? My first thought is go to the easiest room that you can minimize the possessions in and complete that area. So like go to your car first and take everything out of your car that doesn't need to be there, or go to your living room and take everything out of your living room that doesn't need to be there. And when you sit down in that space, it feels calmer and more peaceful, like you're able to focus on the people in the room rather than all the stuff around you. And you'll find that you want that feeling in other areas or in other spaces. Or if someone were to like say, hey, I'm going to minimize my clothes, for example. So like go to your closet and pull out half of the clothes and you don't have to burn them. Like just go put them somewhere else for a little while and just keep your favorite half of your clothes in your closet. And the very next morning when you open your closet, you'll be like, this is kind of nice. Everything hanging here I love, and I don't have to waste time deciding what to wear. It's easier to get ready. It feels less stressful to get ready. So where else can I apply these principles of owning less?
Right. Yeah. I mean, part of what drives consumption, especially when it comes to clothing, oftentimes I think are these different desires that we have, and we seek to satisfy those desires with purchasing, with stuff, with material things in our lives. Can you share, you know, what you feel some of these different desires are that we have, and then how can we keep ourselves from trying to satisfy them with spending?
Well, you know, I noticed it when I started donating things and taking things to Goodwill. I took a van load of stuff to Goodwill and it was great. And a second van load was great. By about the third van load of boxes and bags of things that I was dropping off at Goodwill, I started to ask myself some pretty difficult questions, starting with why in the world did I have three van loads of things in my house that I didn't need? Like why... When you get to the heart of the question, why do we buy more stuff than we need? Like, what could possibly be motivating us to buy more things than we need to own in order to live our life? And so I started asking myself that question. Like, the more bags I filled and the more closets I opened and boxes I went through, and I don't know. I always say I didn't really like what I started to find out about myself, that I was probably motivated by jealousy, you know, trying to impress people with the things that I owned, or trying to prove that I was successful to my parents or my brother, that I was maybe less secure, maybe a little more discontent in my life. Maybe I really was looking for possessions to bring about happiness. Maybe I was a sucker for sales, the Best Buy ad that used to come in the Sunday paper would compel me to go buy things. For some people, it's loneliness or boredom or overcoming stress. Like, what are these triggers that cause us to go buy things? This is probably where I separate myself a little bit from some of the other writers on the topic, because a lot of writers want to blame advertisers and marketing and society and culture. And certainly there's a role that they play. We see like 5,000 advertisements every single day. And so certainly those ads are, but they're feeding into some internal unhealthy motivation that's causing us to go overconsume, and they vary from person to person. So how do you overcome them?
Part of the question, right?
Yeah, and certainly the first step is realizing what they are and being able to recognize them and articulate them. Probably the most helpful way that I've seen people get to that step is by embracing a shopping ban of some sort, whether it's a 2-month shopping ban. Some people go a whole year, but that's pretty long. But most people, I think, could go for 4 to 6 weeks without buying anything other than food, I guess. But just saying, hey, I'm going to spend the next 2 months and I'm not going to buy anything other than food or consumable toiletry items. And every time I have an urge to shop, I'm not going to. And I'm just going to kind of sit in that desire. Why do I feel like I need to go shopping right now? Why do I feel like I need to go buy that newest, latest, greatest thing? Is it a healthy motivation or is it unhealthy? What is sparking some of those things? One lady one time told me she had gone on a 2-month shopping ban, and she said she started to notice every time she had a bad day at work, she really wanted to stop at the mall on her way home. And usually she would just stop at the mall. She said, I didn't always buy anything, but sometimes I just walk through the hallway. A lot of times I bought something, but not always. But for 2 months, when I said I couldn't stop at the mall, I started to notice what days I felt that urge. And I started to realize that when I was really stressed at work, I would go try to alleviate that stress by buying something on my way home. Or whenever I felt lonely or bored, I just want to fill the time by shopping. Whenever there's extra money in my bank account, I just want to go buy something. And recognizing what those are, I think that shopping ban is probably the best way to do that. And then how you overcome it probably depends on what exactly it is that you're discovering. But typically there is a better way to meet that need in your heart and in your life and in your soul than buying something. Certainly a longer lasting way to fulfill it.
Man, I feel like we're demystifying some of those classical things, maybe the parodies of minimalism that people have in their minds. And we're really, man, that was some really good, really good stuff there, Joshua. And so, yeah, for people who want to get started actually going through the process of becoming a minimalist, we want to ask you questions on that subject, and we'll get to a couple of those right after the break.
All right, we're back from the break, and we're talking about minimalism with Joshua Becker. And so, Joshua, let's go ahead and talk about like how we can implement these principles. How do we actually implement more minimalism into our lives, right? If we, like a lot of folks, are swimming in stuff, like how do we even begin the process of decluttering our homes?
Well, I would take a step back, and I would say the first step is for people to articulate their bigger reason why they want to pursue minimalism. When I wrote my first book, The More of Less, and I met with a publisher and they said, what do you want to call it? I said, Becoming Minimalist. And she said, well, you can't name it that. And I'm like, oh, that's how this works.
Like,
but,
oh, okay.
But she says the reason you can't title it Becoming Minimalist is because Becoming Minimalist is the process that gets you to the promise. So the goal of minimalism isn't to become minimalist. The goal of owning less is something bigger. So name your book The Promise, and then, I mean, what is the promise of minimalism? That's what you should title the book. And so we titled it The More of Less, Finding the Life You Want Under Everything You Own. And so the first step, I think, for people is to say, okay, why does this appeal to me right now? What is it that I want to get out of minimalism? And it could be something as simple as I want to get out of debt. And so I'm going to pursue minimalism so that I can get out of debt, or I'm going to pursue minimalism so that I can finally get ahead of my paychecks, or I'm going to pursue minimalism so that I can reach $1 million net worth, right? Like,
those are all good reasons.
Yes, I'm going to pursue minimalism so I can spend more time with my family, so I can do more traveling. Like, there's any number of different things that somebody might pick. So I think it starts there and realizing it. And then from there, certainly if you have a family, there's a conversation to be had that you're hoping to make some changes in your life and in your home. And the greatest problem there is that it's easier to see everyone else's clutter than it is to see your own. So if you're listening to this podcast and you want to pursue minimalism, you don't get started by having your husband or wife get rid of all their things. Like, you get rid of your stuff and you look for common ground with your spouse and with your partner. And then, like I mentioned a little bit earlier in the podcast, don't fall into the trap of, I'm going to tackle the hardest thing first. I'm going to start in my garage. I'm going to start in my basement. I'm going to start by getting rid of my sentimental things. Start easy. Start in your lived-in areas that you can complete and finish and notice the benefits of owning less in one area of your life. And then you'll feel motivated and you'll have momentum to go tackle the next area and the next area.
Joshua, you kind of talked a little bit earlier in the show about how as you were unpacking boxes and bags and going through stuff, you were kind of going through this personal existential sort of thought process about stuff owning you. What was the process like as you were kind of navigating it with your family and with your kids and with your wife? What were those conversations like and how difficult was that?
So my kids were 5 and 2, and I have noticed that there are three types of relationships that emerge from this. There's the spouse who says, "Hooray, where you've been? Let's go." there's a spouse that says, "I'm in. I agree," but they differ on what that looks like in their home. And then the trickiest one to navigate is the spouse who says, "You can't get rid of anything in the home." And that's a pretty small percentage, but that's the toughest one. But for me, it was my wife was in the second boat. And so she was like, "Yeah, I think you're right. We should make some changes here," which is where most people tend to be. It was just that we disagreed on how much stuff we were going to get rid of. And so if she wanted to get rid of 50%, I wanted to get rid of 80%. And so the first 50 felt pretty good. And then I wanted to keep going. And she's like, I think we're at a good spot right here, right? So
let's wrap it up.
So I could still focus on my own things. I could get rid of my own things. In the end, we got rid of about 60-70% of our possessions over about a nine month period. But my kids were 5 and 2. And again, I tell parents, you can't go home and make your kids get rid of all their things first. You do your own rooms. You do all your own stuff. And then you start putting these expectations on your kids. And the younger they are, the easier it is. By the time we got to my kid's toy room and bedroom, like, he had seen us for months taking boxes of things outside the house. And we had explained over and over again, this is why we're doing it. This is what we're hoping will come from that. And by the time we got to their toys and their bedrooms, they knew it was coming. And we were able to, I think, set some rational physical boundaries for them. Like, we're not getting rid of all of your toys. They just need to fit against this wall, or they need to fit in this closet. And you get to decide what to keep and what to get rid of.
Certainly leading by example is a way to ease your family into it. And I think that's so smart. Well, Joshua, you like, so you're mentioning kind of going room by room basically and kind of working your way through your house. Like what you said start with the easier rooms. Like what are those easier rooms? Like what rooms do you recommend for folks to begin with when they are looking to make that change in their house?
Well, they'll change from home to home, but the way I usually say it is easiest to hardest, starting with the most lived in areas first. So what is the easiest, most lived in area of your home? And I know two superlatives isn't always helpful, but so like the living room is a great example for most people because some living rooms becomes a storage area for a lot of things. In that case, it's not an easy room to start in. But for most people, the living room is a good place to start, and you spend time in there. So you can finish it in an afternoon or in an evening, and you can notice the benefits the next time your family sits in that room. The bedroom is also a usually somewhat easy place for people to get started. Bathrooms, like those are easier places, at least they were for me, than the kitchen, the home office, spaces that I use, but we're going to require a lot more time and effort and thought in order to experience the benefits of them.
And Joshua, you know, we're a money podcast. And so lots of times when people are getting rid of stuff, they might say, you know what, I want to sell some stuff and make some money based on the used things that I have that I'm no longer going to have in my life. So when we're talking about the question of donating, selling, recycling, or tossing in the trash, it sounds like you were loading up the van and taking things to the Goodwill. How do you suggest people think through what they do with those things as they're parting with them?
Well, probably a few things to think through. My typical advice is, if you don't need the money, then just donate the stuff. But since this is the money podcast and people are probably a little more focused on those things. So the problem becomes, if you have a lot of stuff to go through, if you've lived in your home for 20 years and you have boxes and boxes of things, trying to sell all that stuff really adds a lot of burden and time and stress and usually frustration to the process and doesn't usually bring back nearly as much financial reward as we think it's going to. There's some exceptions, things that are really expensive or things that are really large and you can't haul them away by yourself. Like there's some easy selling wins along the way, in which case, yeah, sell it, make the money along the way. But there's a certain joy that comes from generosity that selling items can't bring. I think that generosity tends to motivate people when they're getting rid of. So my daughter was two, and so we were getting rid of all of the like baby and newborn and maternity items, and we stumble across the CareNet Pregnancy Center in downtown Burlington, Vermont, and it took like one phone call with them to realize how much need there was in my city for those clothes and those baby supplies that were just being stored in boxes in my basement, like families who legitimately needed those items. It like sparked us to get rid of even more. I'm like, well, let's go back and find even more things that people in our community can use and need. So I tend to defer to the donating side because I think it's more fulfilling. But there's space for selling. One time someone was, they were minimizing, they were new couple and they just moved to a new city and they needed like bicycles to get around in the city to work. And I'm like, I think that'd be a great goal. Like you sell your items until you make enough money to buy the bicycle that you can use to get you around to where you need to go. And so there's certainly freedom in that, but the hard part becomes bogging ourselves down with that pursuit.
Nice. Excellent, Joshua. Man, this has been great stuff. I think our listeners have hopefully been able to glean a lot of what you're saying here and not only apply it to their physical life, right, as far as just the possessions they have in their home. But you know, I think there's a lot of parallels when it comes to our money as well, you know, as far as how we approach what it is that we're seeking after. You kind of mentioned earlier on how we need to start with the, essentially what I interpreted is that you said start with the end in mind. And if you can kind of figure out the type of life that it is you want to live, that can kind of shape minimalism, right? Like minimalism doesn't have to look the same for you as it does the dentist, you know, like all the different examples you gave. And I think that the same can be so true of our money. When we have the end goal in mind and what we want to do with that money, then that kind of that drives us and feeds our soul to finish the task and not to get, you know, not to fall off the wagon along the way.
Yeah, it's essentially about intentionality. It's about being intentional with my money and my time and my pursuits and making sure that all of my resources are aligned with my values and the person I want to be and the life I want to end up living.
Well, Joshua, we really appreciate you taking your time to spend with us and sharing all your wisdom with our listeners. This was an excellent conversation. For folks that do want more information, that are really interested now in at least thinking about minimalism a good bit more, yeah, how can they find out more about the stuff that you've written and what you're up to?
BecomingMinimalist.com is the home base for everything that I do. And there's certainly books and the Hope Effect, hopeeffect.com. But BecomingMinimalist.com is the home base for everything I do. And you can find anything else I'm doing and where I can be found from there.
Well, Joshua, thanks again so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Matt, that was an excellent conversation. I think I say that every time because we have just the best guests. Whoever does the guest booking for our show is awesome.
Yeah, who does that, by the way? I don't know.
I think it's you and me.
Yeah.
We're awesome.
Patting ourselves on the back.
But Joshua was even better. And so I want to know from you, like, what was your big takeaway from our conversation with Joshua?
Well, Joel, you know how I am about goals, right? Goal setting, knowing the big picture, having an understanding of why it is that I'm doing something. Like, that is so important to me as a human being. Whether it be, you know, just like a little project that I'm doing outside, you know, the question I'm asking myself is, how is this contributing to my larger plan, like the larger goal I have for the yard, right? And it goes all the way to minimalism. Like Joshua was mentioning how we need to start with our goal in mind, and that kind of dictates what it looks like to be a minimalist. And I think it so applies to our money as well. We talk about this all the time, how we need to start with the why behind our money. Because if we don't really have a clear goal of what it is that we're trying to achieve, then it's going to be difficult for us to do the hard work of not spending our money. But when we are informed and we have a clear goal that we're chasing after, that makes everything so easy. And something Joshua mentioned in his book that we actually didn't talk about, but was he talked about how it's important to revisit these goals as well. A lot of times we don't exactly know what it is that we're seeking after. Because bottom line, our tastes change, like our opinions change, we have different goals, our goals, you know, our cheese gets moved, and it takes time to sort of recalibrate a little bit. And that's also true if you don't necessarily know what your goals are right now. Just because you don't know what your financial goals are, that doesn't mean that you fail to do smart things with your money. Because eventually, through this process, you will figure it out what it is that you want to spend your money on.
They'll come to light.
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing with minimalism. You may not necessarily know what it is that you're trying to achieve by having fewer possessions, but through the process of minimizing your possessions, you're going to figure out what it is, whether it's more time with your family, or maybe that means just having more mental space because you have fewer things kind of clouding your judgment. It still makes sense to do the smart things that we talk about a lot of times here on the show, even if you don't yet know what it is you're seeking after.
Yeah, and I really identify kind of with the more stuff taking up more mental space.
Yeah.
Emily and I have been kind of taking some of these things to heart based on reading the books and lead up to this interview with Joshua, and it's making a difference already, I can tell. The lack of clutter is really bringing some mental clarity when we're hanging out in our house, and that's so nice. I think my big takeaway from this episode was that you won't necessarily save money as a minimalist. But I got to say, for our How to Money listeners, you will, right? The way our people...
you should.
Yeah, the way our listeners, our peeps, the way they approach money, if they begin to kind of consider the concepts of minimalism and begin to declutter and be generous with the things that they have that they're not actually using, and they buy fewer things, I think they will save money. Implementing a shopping ban for a month or two, like Joshua suggested. I mean, those are ways that we're going to actually implement minimalism and save money at the same time. And I think that's the best of both worlds. If we begin to at least at minimum take some of these concepts, you don't have to go all the way full minimalist. And I think we address some of those misconceptions too. But if you can take some of the good or all the good from minimalism, either way, however far you want to dive into it, I think by embracing that at the same time, you will, if you're a How to Money listener, be embracing frugality. They're cousins. They're not the same. But if you kind of take both hand in hand at the same time, man, I think it's going to have a big difference, a major impact in your life going forward.
Yeah, totally, man. I think that those shopping bands, it's a good way to kind of self-experiment a little bit and figure out how you're going to take to it a little bit. And hopefully you will be able to see that there's some amazing ways that you can save money that way. But dude, let's take it to the beer. On this episode, we had I Feel It All, which is a beer by Monday Night Brewing. This is one that's actually, this is one of the three beers that we gave away via Instagram, actually, a few weeks ago. So yeah. If you're not following us on Instagram, look up How to Money Pod.
If you're not following us on Instagram, what are you doing with your life?
but Joel, what were your thoughts on this beer?
Well, man, this beer is called I Feel It All. I felt the hops. it really did have hop concentrate sort of levels of hoppiness going on. But man, and for me in a good way, I know some people can get hopped out, can be over hopped. And I'm not one of those people. I've not found a beer yet where it's been too hoppy. And so this was a ridiculous amount of hops in there. I felt it was like super green, super tasty, super alive. And I loved it.
Yeah, I think the green little alligators on the label there kind of lends itself to the, like the herbal nature of hops as well.
Yeah.
You know, like the Lacoste alligator?
Oh, that's totally like
it. It's kind of like that, but it's like this repeating pattern. I really dig this design. But yeah, this was a hazy New England style IPA. So when we poured it, man, it was super cloudy. Like you could not see through it at all. And it had more of that sort of sharp hop flavor. It makes me think of cheese, right? Like you've kind of got your mild or medium, like your regular cheddar cheese, but then you get the sharp stuff. And it kind of has like this, like it bites a little bit, you know, like it's sharp cheddar and you kind of feel it on your tongue a little bit more. And I feel like that's how it is with hops sometimes. Like when you have some of these New England style IPAs that do have a lot of hops, sometimes it feels like a sharp cheese. And this isn't the first time I've alluded to cheese before when it comes to these beers, but this one had a similar thing going on. I really dug it. And I'm glad that you and I got to share this one today, buddy.
Yeah, man. Pick that up at the beer's release at Monday Night Brewing.
Oh yeah, man. We're big fans.
We go out once every 6 months and this was one of those times.
Exactly. Well, man, that's going to be it for this episode. Our listeners can find our show notes up at howtomoney.com.
Yeah, man, we've had so many great reviews from our listeners, but I do want to ask if you have a friend that could use a kick in the pants when it comes to living a minimalist lifestyle, spending less money, saving more of what you make. Well, then we would suggest letting your friend know about the How to Money podcast, maybe sneaking their phone, hitting the subscribe button for them, whatever it takes. Okay.
Just hold that phone up in front of their face so it gets that facial recognition and then just swipe over to podcast real quick. Make it happen. And especially with this episode, man, this was such a fun conversation that we had with Joshua Becker. I think this can be a kind of a soft introduction to personal finance where it's not so money on the nose.
Yeah, not too in your face. But all right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.